Let's talk. John Brown. Operation Wrath of God, the secret history of European intelligence and Mossad's assassination campaign. It's an unprecedented history of intelligence cooperation during the Cold War. The book is called Operation Wrath of God. It's by Aviva Gutman. I'd like to say that Aviva joins me live on the line now. Aviva, good morning to you.
Good morning to you too.
Good to have you. Whereabouts are you, by the way, this morning?
I'm in Wales. That's why I live and teach and research. Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful stuff. God's own country. Wonderful stuff indeed. Set the back. A lot of people will probably only kind of know this story, if you like, through the film that came out, I was going to say, a couple of years ago. Now it's probably about two decades with Daniel Craig and Munich, it was called, wasn't it? The film was called Munich. So explain, if you would, a little bit of the background to Operation Wrath of God.
Okay, indeed. So the story of Operation Wrath of God is sort of a bit of a known story. As you said, there is a movie. But the crazy thing is, there is no need to invent anything. Reality is crazier than fiction, really. So it starts basically with a sort of a watershed moment in terrorism history, in the history of European international relations and Israeli history, with the Munich Olympics attack. And I'm not going into too many details. Again, it's a known story that there was a Palestinian organization, Black September organization, managed to enter the Olympic Village in Munich in 1972 and take 11 Israeli hostages. The German local authorities, the police, tried to attempt a rescue operation, and it failed horribly, and all these Israeli officers were killed. This led to outrage, grief, and sadness in Israel. It was their pride has been wiped out, and there was a lot of requests for revenge, for something had to be done. So we had the Israeli prime minister at the time standing in front of the parliament and said, "We will avenge these killers." And I mean, there are some parallels to be drawn to the 7th of October, but we may be able to touch on that in a bit later stage. But in a similar vein, there was a unit that was established, tasked mainly to the Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad, to hunt and kill everybody who has been identified as being involved in the Munich Olympics attack, the terrorists who were responsible for that. And a lot of them were living in Europe. So the Israelis decided to kill one by one of Israelis. The Israelis decided to kill a Palestinian living in Europe who they thought were either previously involved in terrorist attacks or planning future attacks. So that's Operation Wrath of God. So that's a known story, as I said. Yeah. What my book brings in for sort of the first time is that the Israelis were not doing it alone. It's seen as an Israeli operation, but in fact, the European agencies where these operations happened were helping Mossad.
Because if you set this in a historical context, I mean, you are looking at a time when terrorism is not just affecting, you know, it's not just a strike against the Israeli athletes in the Olympic Village. There are machine gun attacks taking place at airports. There are liners there are planes being hijacked and then blown up. There is well-scared chaos with, you know, the PLO, the people, the Palestine Liberation Army, there are all sorts of various, I mean, you can draw a parallel with the Bleeding Life of Brian and there are so many different, you know, groups setting off on themselves. Plus this wide scale sort of, pseudo Marxist thing with the IRA, with the Red Brigades, with the Baader-Meinhof, with obviously ETA in this country. So there is a widespread terrorist threat. So it is in the interests of European democracies to have cooperation. And, you know, if Mossad wants to go and knock off a few terrorist organizations or those financing it, then in the politics of the early 70s, this is not a bad thing.
No, you're absolutely right to point out the broader context of all of that. Absolutely. With tourism becoming an increasing industry, At the time, you could just walk into a plane. You didn't have any of the security measures. And precisely because of this terrorist threat at the time, because they realized they can hijack planes really easily because they were not being searched for any weapons. So, yes, absolutely. I think the Europeans kind of woke up to this new threat in the 1970s. And we're like, first of all, who are those Palestinians? Who are those left-wing extremists who want to create, you know, who want to, you know, harm the civilians? I mean, that's what terrorism is. You know, you want to kill one, frighten 10. That's like a very basic, you know, that's a saying to summarize terrorism. So definitely the European governments were trying to understand the threat, to try and get hold of the threat, trying to develop counterterrorism policies more or less from scratch. And cooperating with Israelis made a lot of sense in that respect. And they were getting, I think, also increasingly dependent on foreign partners because Israelis just had more knowledge and had more, you know, infiltration capabilities. That being said, the Mossad was really good with Palestinians operating in the Middle Eastern region, but they needed the help of the Europeans then to kind of combine forces to get the bigger picture together. Again, in the post-Munich context of who was involved in Munich, but also what were the terrorists up to next? So it was a fear. It was sort of fear-driven and bit of a chaotic time, I would say, because the governments were just like, well, what's that? It's like, you know, 9/11 was not the first time governments are struck by terrorism. It happened way before. And this kind of like waking up to a new threat and trying to understand it and understanding that cooperation is key to counter this threat. That happened, I would say, in the early 70s.
So of the governments out there, of the intelligent networks, presumably we are looking at the UK, I mean, obviously the MI5 would be helping out here. The Germans, I would imagine, with their intelligence agencies too. I can see a stumbling block here because it's where a lot of the action takes place, and that would be the French intelligence services. Are they going to help Mossad in this case? Are they going to give intelligence, or are they perhaps a little more reserved in their intelligence sharing?
Interesting. Started with, let's go back to this realization that there is an increased need for cooperation. Right. So there existed a so-called Club de Bern. It's named after the Swiss capital.
Yep.
And it's basically a group of heads of intelligence agencies, of the domestic intelligence agencies. So you rightly said MI5, the Bundesamt für Verfassungsschutz, the DST, other ones who just say the heads come together and have coffee twice a year.
Sounds delightful.
So they decide on the priorities for the next year and how to improve cooperation. And then one of those meetings in 71, Mossad was also invited and suggested to install a channel, a direct channel from intelligence agency to intelligence agency whenever it concerns Palestinian terrorism, that they have any updates that they want the others to have, so that they're direct links to one another. And that's where an interesting thing happens in international relations, because it's something is new when intelligence agencies can have a direct link to one another, where they can sort of bypass official foreign policy. They just can call up their colleague, their almost friend, because they know each other on a daily basis now. I'm sorry, I was losing track. You were asking me a more specific question.
I'm thinking, because an awful lot of the Palestinians are based in France, basically.
Yeah, so you were asking me French. Uh-huh. Yes, the French were, I would say, there were countries who were sharing intelligence. There are some contrarians, as you could see. Yeah. I think the Germans, for instance, had an element of guilt that this Munich happened on their territory. So they were very active. They were very proactive in sharing intelligence and giving everything that they could find on the Palestinian diaspora in Germany and giving that to the Israelis and all the other partners. The French, they were helping in a different way. So a lot of the assassinations happened on French territory. Okay. And then after these assassinations, there were police reports, there was police investigations. At the very beginning, it was not entirely clear that it was Mossad who was killing those people. But after a while, it became clear. Also, you have to think that for this operation to make sense, it had to have a communicative aspect. So the Palestinians in Europe who were potentially planning an attack, they needed to fear for their lives. They needed to know that they were not sure anymore in their beds where they're sleeping. They were not sure, not safe anymore in the cars that they were taking. So they had to know that Mossad was behind it. So we can assume that the French knew or at least suspected that it was Mossad who may have been the killers. But they were then using this kilowatt channel, the Club de Bern channel, and shared the police investigations. So after every assassination, they were telling the murderers, updating them on the murder investigation. And I'm reading this as a sort of a covert signal to say, look, Israelis, we're not going to dig too deep into these cases. We are sort of, sending
gonna
you...
We're going to pay lip service to the investigation, but nothing's going to come out of it, basically.
By sharing everything that the police currently allegedly knows about an investigation, sharing that with Mossad, it kind of says, we are going to look the other way. We're not going to look too deep into this murder case. So it's a sort of a tacit support that I'm detecting here. So that's one way. And it was important for Mossad to know also, have we been detected? Will we be likely to be detected? And how would they react if we were to be detected?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because if you think of, again, the time frame, this is 1972, 1973. This is basically only 11, 12 years after Mossad have lifted Eichmann from Argentina. And they've been through that Kiev. So, you know, in parallel to this campaign, they're running against, you know, getting rid of or striking against terrorism Palestinians. They're still picking up and scaring the living proverbials out of Nazis wherever they be, maybe whatever rock they're hiding under. So they've got some experience with doing this and working, you know, out on the very fringes of what you would call, you know, civilized, not civilized, but, you know, that behavior that is deemed between states. So it's not like it's their first rodeo, as you'd say in what's it parlance, but so they do have experience and they do have that sort of knowledge of how to carry out covert assassinations and, if needed, kidnappings.
Yes. I think there's a bit of a tradition, as you would say, in Israeli policy, that, you know, there's a Talmudic saying, rise and kill first. So you want to kill those before they can kill you. And I think that is something that we see throughout the Israeli state security policy. And similarly today, right? I mean, after the 7th of October, again, there is this operation, a Neely operation, as it's called today, who is in charge of finding out who was in charge of the 7th of October attack and to try to wipe out all the Hamas leaders who could be identified. So there is a consistency in this counterterrorism security strategy.
You mentioned that, so you're trying to, one of the aims is to terrify the Palestinians who are behind the killings in Munich. Is there evidence that they kind of know? I mean, they're going to know it's when they start being, you know, assassinated and things start blowing out, when people start getting bullets. Presumably, they're going to know it's Mossad. But the thing is, it's the ease in which they can strike because they haven't had this capacity before. Palestine. I mean, what are the first, if you like, sort of successes in Operation of Wrath of God?
All right. Okay. Right. The first assassination happened in Rome. And it was against Walz Weiter, who was the working for the Libyan embassy. And yes, I think the successes were really that it was surgical strikes. It killed exactly the people that they had planned in the way that they had planned. The name of this operation was given later, but it can have two reasons. One is that it's an offense against the gods to disturb the Olympic truce. So Operation Wrath of God, you know, to avenge that. But also they were playing gods. They were killing these people really in the beds where they're sleeping. And I think the successes is that they were able to do so without harming any other people. But also, yes, the goal was to kill them so that everybody would know that it was the Israelis who had pulled the trigger, but without leaving any incriminating traces.
So what was the, I mean, how do you go about writing a book? When, I mean, obviously, as we said before, it is, we do, there's no point rehashing the first part of what happened at Munich, because obviously everybody knows about it. So what happens afterwards is, again, it's shrouded in folklore, in movie things. So when Aviva, did this cross your, if you like, your radar, and you thought, I really want to look at this further? And is there stuff being released now that sort of pulls back the curtain on what was happening over 50 years ago?
Absolutely. So it started with me looking actually at these intelligence sharing. At the beginning, I was simply looking at how were these European and Israeli governments dealing with the threat of terrorism? How were they approaching it? What measures did they start taking? And then I kind of linked that to what Mossad was doing. And I was genuinely interested to see whether the Europeans changed their intelligence sharing behavior once they may have realized that the information that they were providing could be used for Operation Wrath of God to kill in an extrajudicial way Palestinian citizens. And so I was surprised to see that nothing changed at all. It was as if this operation had not happened. It was as if this assassinations they didn't matter, basically. So that was the puzzle. And what I thought was really interesting, it shows kind of two levels, right? On the official level, the European governments were kind of condemning a lot of the Israeli policies at the time. We already have settlement policies. The Europeans were criticizing that. But on a secret level, they were intensely cooperating with the Israelis. And I think because it was able to be kept secret, they could do that. They could have very good trade relations with the Arab world, who may not have been so keen if they had known that the Europeans were also, you know, working against Arab countries or, you know, Palestinians with the Israelis on a secret level. So there is a sort of a mismatch or an incident, well, I would call it from a more research perspective. It's really interesting to see that the international relations of the secret state operate sort of in a different logic than the official foreign policy of these states.
And you mentioned it's not just about the, it's not just about killing in revenge, but also that this information sort of stops planned terrorist attacks as well in their tracks, and you've found some information about that as well. I mean, what were they planning? Wide scale bombings, more machine gunnings. What were the Palestinians up to next then?
They were, for a lot of times, they were using women, and especially also so there was one plot that I thought was really interesting. They were convincing English tourists, young women, to take a gift home on their plane, to take a gift to Israel on their plane as a tourist to Israel. But in fact, this was not a gift. This was a bomb inside of a record player. And this did not happen simply because the plane was not, on high altitude enough. So they took a different plane than they Palestinians wanted them to take, and so that made the bomb not explode.
This is the mercury thing with the flight. If you go up to a certain thing, the mercury will explode, and that will set off the action that blows the plane up.
Exactly. So it was a plane that was not high enough. So they were, and then the intelligence agencies were able to find a whole network of Palestinians who were working with women, yeah, trying to flirt them with them, trying to lure them into terrorist plots without the actual knowledge at the beginning, at least. This is something that the intelligence agencies discover and were able then to prevent, because they were able to expose these Palestinians who were working on that. So yes, airplane sabotage was really, really a major threat at the time. And through intelligence cooperation, they were able to thwart those attacks.
What are you hoping that people will discover? Are there any lessons to be learned? I suppose cooperation between intelligence agencies is maybe one of the main things, and that's maybe something that maybe the UK is missing out of because of what after the Brexit sort of thing, and they've pulled out of intelligence organisation of some of the intelligence sharing. I mean, what are you hoping that people will discover? Is it historical, or obviously are there, I don't want to go too deep in this, but are there parallels with you know the situation at the moment?
I think one key element that we can also draw parallels for today is that intelligence sharing is happening on a massive scale. And there's a degree of lack of oversight. We don't really know what information is being shared because it just says it is secret. If any government can make it, or any intelligence agency can make a claim, oh, this might concern a third party, then they can just say, we don't have to disclose this. So there is, it's hugely difficult to regulate intelligence sharing, but maybe this should be done. Maybe on the European level, we might need a law that puts categories into place that lets an intelligence agency share intelligence or not. I mean, even at the time, data protection was not a thing, but I wonder to what extent today intelligence agencies are adhering to the data protection rights, simply because nobody is really watching what information is being transferred. So this is something that we can think about today. We know intelligence sharing is crucially important, but we also know that nobody really watches the watches.
The book is called Operation Wrath of God. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Go to the bookstore on tre.radio. You'll see a picture of the front cover. Click on it and it'll be winging its way to you. If people want to find you online, where's the best place to follow what you're up to, Aviva?
Well, you can go on Blue Sky.
And that's the easiest place to find. The book is called Operation Wrath of God.
You will find me there. So you can also go to my university. You probably won't be able to pronounce that, but it's called Aberystwyth.
Aberystwyth. Yes, I am aware of that. I'm aware of Aberystwyth. Don't worry about that. The book is called...
I'll be back with one Aberystwyth. You will find me there.
Marvellous stuff. The book is called Operation Wrath of God. Aviva, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. My pleasure as well.